Welcome to the Pint and Click podcast. I'm Dave. I'm here with Jamie and Tony, and we're here to recommend some movies, some books, some TV shows to you from the Des Plaines Public Library. We are all librarians and librarian assistants, and we love nothing more than to give you recommendations for things you can check out, hopefully at the library, but sometimes it's something on TV. We'll let you know how to get it. Today, I'm going to start off talking about something that I saw. We're going to go around the table, and then at the end, we're all going to talk about the new Star Wars movie, Rogue One. So I'm going to begin. I saw The Young Pope on HBO. It just premiered. It's their new Sunday night show. And it is a little weird, to say the least. It started off a little bizarre, and then it just got kind of more subtly strange. So let's just dive right in. If you haven't seen the first episode yet, it begins with a baby crawling over a pile of sleeping babies, out of which Jude Law, the young pope that it's named after, emerges. That turns out to be a dream, which is fine, but still, it's a bizarre dream. But then he goes into another dream where he's giving his homily at the basilica, and he goes off on a rant about all these things that maybe a pope shouldn't endorse, particularly their first day on the job. That turns out to be a dream. Then he wakes up again, and now it's real. All right, no more dreams. And he's very standoffish. He's very abrasive. The character is a little bizarre. You know, he comes to breakfast and he just kind of makes enemies with everyone in the room. He's a very strange character. And that kind of sets the tone for the show, where it's kind of Jude Law plays this character, Pope Pius XIII, and he is seemingly ill-suited for the job. People don't seem to like him. He doesn't seem to like them. You're not entirely sure how he was elected in the first place. There's some rumblings about political gnashing at the conclave. The show just kind of navigates that. Who likes the Pope? Who doesn't like the Pope?
Is it supposed to be now? Like a contemporary?
Yes. Okay. Yes, absolutely. It's modern times. You know, there are cell phones and the like and all that good stuff. But it's very weird. And I don't think it's particularly well written. I found myself bored at times.
Okay.
I felt scenes like I would get the point of the scene. All right, he doesn't like this person, and he's making it clear that he doesn't like this person, but he just keeps ranting, and I'm like, this should move on. I get it. Let's go. But the show is phenomenally well acted, but strangely or poorly written, and it's very hard to look away, very engrossing, but very confusing and very boring at the same time. Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's one of those that this is the pilot episode and that maybe some of these kinks will get worked out later on as we get to know the characters better, that they won't have to do as much exposition type script stuff? Or do you feel like this is a flaw that could carry through the entire season?
I'm not sure. So the characters were set up in the pilot episode. So there was that aspect to it. Maybe we're going to get off and rolling after this. There's, I want to put it like a Game of Thrones moment. I don't want to ruin it if you haven't seen the show yet, but there's a big reveal towards the end of the episode, which reminds me of, you know, Bran being pushed at the very beginning of the first book of Game of Thrones. That was not that compelling.
Okay.
It was obviously a big moment. The character the Pope was talking to had a strong reaction, but I was like, yeah, this is kind of what I expected from this character. It's not something bizarre. It's not something out of left field. Otherwise, the costume design is wonderful. The set design is wonderful. The extras are excellent in just emoting with their faces in the background and things like this. Like, there were some real bizarre scenes that turned out to be dream sequences where it was an extra's face who had no lines that, you know, really kind of made the scene and made the moment stand out. So I found it compelling, but weird. I found, like, not only is the young pope standoffish, but the show is standoffish.
Okay.
Like, the show kind of dares you to like it, I feel.
Like, I was going to ask, does it make an effort to, I mean, you said it kind of gives you a setup, but does it make an effort to, like, engross you in a plot further than beyond this episode? Is it really setting anything out beyond that other than just this drama?
There's no strong sense of plot in this first episode, for sure. There is a strong sense of character and character interactions. It's not a spoiler to say there is a Sister Mary who we learn is the Pope's mother, biological mother, but it's a secret. No one knows because she is a nun. And he grew up in her orphanage, presumably as an orphan. That's what the other orphans believe, that he was just an orphan just like them. But she's actually living in his mother's house somewhat. And there's allusions to you have to let go of your past. You have to let go of your pain because now you have to lead the church. And it's like, well, what pain? What this? What that? And is that going to be interesting when it's revealed or not? I'm not really sure. I'm going to keep watching because I think it can get better. Because like I say, the acting is great. The set design is great. The costumes are great. It's very atmospheric. It's a lot of very wide shots and close-ups. Like the Pope in his enormous office and then a close-up of the person he's talking to just right on their face. So it's definitely interesting from a visual point of view, but as far as plot goes, it's not very strong. Certainly not as strong as some of the stuff we've recommended on the podcast before.
So you said that this is the Sunday time slot. Do you feel like this, is it trying to, and do you think it will capture the attention of the Game of Thrones, Westworld, that type of crowd who's used to these epics on a grand scheme where you have... You know, it's not even necessarily that this is in contemporary times, but we're used to having huge cast of characters, tons of storylines, all this, like, epic drama. Will this be interesting?
I think it's trying to catch that audience in its own way, not through the epic storylines, unfortunately. There doesn't seem to be much of a storyline at all, except for this secret past he has. Some of it that we know about with his mother, some of it just alluded to. But in the grand scheme of things, it's not like nations hang in the balance or kings live and die. It's just kind of seems like, well, he's the Pope and he's kind of standoffish and people don't like that. It's got a sense of scope and scale where he's giving an address before thousands of people. Just no story yet. No story yet. So maybe it'll come along, maybe not. But I kind of half recommend the new Pope. The young Pope. He is the new Pope, but he's the young Pope is the name of the show. Let's hope it gets better.
One more question. Sure. Are there any big names besides Jude Law that we would recognize?
Diane Keaton is Sister Mary, the mother. Okay. The mother of the Pope. Other than that, I didn't recognize anyone by face.
Okay.
I didn't recognize anyone by name, though they all did a phenomenal job of either being compelling or weird. A lot of just weird-looking characters, which I kind of think is by design, because these are like men who have lived in the Vatican for 30 years. Yeah. Like, they don't have social pressures to have conventional haircuts or speak with slang. The dialect is a little strange, and the haircuts are a little strange, and the interactions are a little strange. And so I think that's all kind of accurate to the setting and makes for a compelling show, but I just want a reason to watch, and I don't quite have that yet. So that was The Young Pope. It's on HBO. It'll be at the library someday, I'm sure, on DVD. But for right now, you have to have HBO to see it. I'll keep watching.
Yeah, give us an update.
I will. Yeah. I will, if it gets any better or not. So let's move on to Jamie. Jamie, what are you going to talk about today?
I'm going to be talking about the book Confessions, which has an ominous title, and it is an ominous book. And it is by Kanaye Minato. So it's translated from the Japanese. The English translation came out in 2014, so it's relatively new. But the book originally came out in 2008. And I knew nothing about this book before I started listening to it on Hoopla, our streaming service. I was just looking for Japanese writers, and I saw this one, and I was like, it's only 5 hours, might as well start listening to it. And then I was hooked. So this is a psychological thriller, I would say, but in a different sense than the type we're used to here, I guess. Tonally, maybe it might be close to Gone Girl. It's told in five different segments, each with a different narrator. And the first narrator is a school teacher talking to her students. So she's addressing them, and it's the last day of school, and she's telling them, I'm not going to be coming back to teach you here in middle school next year. You might be wondering if this is because of what happened to my daughter. It is, but it's not what you think. So the whole first chapter, the first hour or so of this narrative, if you're listening to an audiobook, is her telling the story of her daughter, her four-year-old daughter, who accidentally drowned, and how she found out that it was her students, actually, who killed her daughter. And she unfolds the whole story as if she's telling it to all her students. And she's telling them, without naming the names of the two students, why they did it, why each one tried to they collaborated together and what actually happened to her daughter, which was that it was made to look like she drowned at the school pool, but she actually was electrocuted. By these 12-year-olds or 13-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the first chapter, there's a big shock. I'm not going to give it away, but she has done something to those students as she's telling this story that is revealed at the end, which is just shocking, I thought, and also very powerful in that it sets in motion all the next chapters. Each of the following chapters is narrated by a different person who was affected by this. Mm-hmm. And so we get different viewpoints from other characters. And so one of them is one of the murderers, another one's the other murderer, one was another girl who was in the class. So we see the same incident over again from each of their story perspectives, but they all fill in different gaps, and some of it's told a little later, some of it's told a little earlier, and they're all told to a very specific audience. Mm-hmm. So one person is writing in her blog on her website, one is pretending that she's writing in a journal, one boy is writing from the mental institution, like, as a letter. So they all have very specific audience, which I thought was an interesting narrative choice. There's always a specific you. Mm-hmm. But you always get the sense during the whole thing that something's about to drop. Because these kids, as they show it, first seem pathological, like they're sociopathic, they killed this innocent girl. But then the frightful thing is that you see how things unveil, that you kind of feel for them, that they are on one level sociopaths, but on another level, like, these horrifying things have all happened to end up with these situations in this way. Mm-hmm. But at the end, there's also another very violent event. So we keep having these kind of shocks of the things people do to each other, and it's all told very calmly and very, like, coolly from a very, I would even say, detached standpoint, even though they're all first-person narratives. Yeah. So you have all this, like, psychological horror and death and people killing each other and teachers doing this to their students and students doing this to other students, and they're all really young. So it's very creepy, but also very good.
You listen to the whole thing as opposed to reading any of it?
Yeah. Okay. I'm not sure if the library even has it. If we don't have it, I will put in a request. Yeah. But I listened to it, and the two people who read it were very good. There was a female and a male, and so the female read all the different female characters and the male read the male ones. But it scared me. I listened to it over a sequence, maybe 3 or 4 days, and there are some points where I was like, I'm not sure if I want to listen to this right now. It's so creepy and just very chilling. Yeah. And it's actually part of this subgenre of mystery in Japan that they call Iyamisu, which stands for ew mysteries. So mysteries that make you go ew, because they show the dark side of life. So they're kind of just like dark, creepier ones. And the blurb on the audiobook said, this is like if Albert Camus wrote Heathers. And I would agree with that, kind of. It's very existential and kind of the Japanese way, where everything is also, as they're talking about these things, that there's also this metaphysical or kind of philosophical aspect of it as they're considering what they're doing. There's a lot of meditating as you see these sociopaths, but they also have like this meditative aspect towards it, which I think we don't have necessarily in our psychological thrillers to the same level. So that was interesting. And the fact that it's all 13-year-old kids is, keep you up at night.
Sure. I'm almost afraid to ask any questions about this book because I don't want to spoil anything on the one half, and I kind of don't want to know anymore on the other half. So, like, it sounds to me like the characters don't interact very much if they're writing letters and if they're writing in journals.
They do interact a lot because a lot of this happens after the fact, where they're all trying to process the events that have happened.
Okay.
So they're retelling what had happened from their perspective.
I see.
A lot of the events are told, like, one incident is told from all different 5 perspectives. Mm-hmm. So they're all relating things that happened earlier, but there's a lot of traumatic aftermath that they write about themselves. So a lot of it is when the point that they're narrating from, they're by themselves, they're alone at that point, but they're relating the effects from
before. I see. Yeah. Okay.
Because of the kind of warnings in general, like you said, shock value that this book has, like, is it particularly gory or evocative in the images, or even like disturbing in a way, or is it just more like,
I would say no, it's not gory at all. Okay. It's very clinical. None of the content would be inappropriate, you know, for someone who is over like 12 or 13 years old or anything like that. But it's just that the way it's told, which is very cool, has that essence of like sociopathy. I think that is kind of...
Sure. That's kind of what I was getting at. Where does the tone feed into the creepiness?
Yeah. Is that people are just speaking very logically about the things that they're doing. And it's not even like they try to explain it away. Like one boy who's about to, you know, do something very destructive. He's like, I know people will look at me after this and they'll try to read into my mind and ask, why did I do these things? They'll try to give me a diagnosis. They'll say I was a psychopath, a sociopath, but I'm not. And this is why I'm going to tell you my story. Mm-hmm. And then tells this his whole long narrative. Mm-hmm. It's pretty interesting.
Very neat.
All right, so that was Confessions, which was an audiobook on Hoopla.
Yeah.
If you're a Des Plaines library patron, you can listen to it for free streaming on Hoopla. All right, thank you, Jamie. I'm a little shaky now after that.
Is it cold in here all of a sudden?
Yeah, a little bit. So let's move on to Tony. Tony, what are you going to talk about
today? Sure, I'm going to share about Clone Wars animated series that came out in 2003. It's different from the Clone Wars CG series in that it's two-dimensional animated short films or short episodes. The original episodes, when they aired, were only about 3 to 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And they're by a famous animator, Jenny Tartakovsky, who did Dexter's Laboratory, Samurai Jack, Powerpuff Girls. So a lot for Cartoon Network. And this also originally aired on Cartoon Network. So it takes place in the Star Wars universe in between episodes 2 and 3. And it picks up where a lot of that action left off. And so if you remember the prequels at all, there's a lot of action and a lot of fighting and at the end of Attack of the Clones, the second episode. And this does a pretty awesome job of painting a really cool picture of war in the sense that it's kind of, it's on Cartoon Network, so it's for kids. It paints these action sequences by really taking its time in a way you wouldn't expect for short 3-minute episodes. Mm-hmm. Even just watching the first opening sequences of the first season, there's 3 seasons and each of them only has about 10 episodes, so they run about a half hour.
Sure.
And I think the whole thing overall, I think some of the episodes later get longer, the whole thing is only about 2 hours long. But even just over the first few episodes, you get this really cool sense of like visual communication of information. So you'll have clone fighters in these helmets. You can't see any emotion on their face, but they're signaling 1, 2, 3 with their hands, and you go over here, you go over here. And they're coordinating like really sophisticated attacks. I guess maybe by a lot of standards, you'd be watching this and maybe think like, this isn't really giving me any plot or this isn't giving me any character, because it is very a stone cold like war sequence with really no, maybe there's one general or one character in some of these sequences. And the whole show isn't like this, but this is just an example. And then like when things do precipitate and happen, it's really neat and you get a good payoff. There's a mm-hmm. lot of like stillness, maybe even the music will stop for a while. There'll be some kind of like tension building. And then all of a sudden it seems like the action will precipitate into results and it's a very good payoff. So mm-hmm. even in the short 3 to 5 minute span. So there's really cool, I would almost call them vignettes or short stories of like Mace Windu taking on like an entire clone army with, he loses his lightsaber in like a dust storm and he has to like beat them up with like force kung fu. And it's very visceral and very funny at the same time as being like, it's like funny because it's over the top and rewarding because you get to see something that you always wanted to see. Maybe in the context, like you know that maybe Mace Windu, this Jedi Master, is so powerful and great, but you never get to see him quite take on an army like single-handedly. Mm-hmm. I guess it just brings out this side of characters that films don't ever really give you the format to see. Mm-hmm. And it also does a great job of showing scale. So putting not just like 2,000 ships on a screen or hundreds of ships, they tend to like blow things out even further. And with this 2D animation style, they can really like render so many images mm-hmm. on the screen that it really lends a sense of scale to Star Wars that really none of the movies did, even after the new prequels. This is like, they took scale and like really blew it up and really made just an enormous sense of scale. Like the sheer numbers on the screen is just really, really cool. So I recommend it just based on the way that these vignettes play out and the way that the tension is built. I mean, you see some Anakin Skywalker, you see some General Grievous and Obi-Wan. General Grievous is really dark and like scary, and that he's like a hunting Jedi, and the Jedi, like, you can see the fear on their 2D animated faces, and they just do a really good job of like using shadows and using perspective mm-hmm. In all these scenes. So it's very, they like do a really good job of setting the tone, and again with like slowing the pace down and making it so that it's like you're really anticipating what's going to happen and then paying off. So again, it's just a really strong Star Wars piece of media that I don't think that many people know about, and I think mm-hmm. you should check mm-hmm. it out if you're into Star Wars or if you're into animation of any kind. So you probably heard about it if you're into animation, but
yeah. I remember seeing it when it was coming out live. They almost aired them like commercials because they are so short. They would mm-hmm. air it like between episodes of whatever, Dexter's Lab mm-hmm. on Cartoon Network. and they would just kind of pop out of nowhere and create this little moment for you where it was like, they almost seem like my first samurai movie, like the Fisher-Price Samurai set, however you want to put it, where it's very still and the camera will pan, but the character will be still, and moments like that that you get in the real samurai films and then explode into action.
Yeah.
But, you know, Star Wars characters and some levity sometimes. But mostly it was just like, let's create a very strong sense of place, a very strong sense of character for the next 2-3 minutes. And it was very effective at doing that. I remember the first ones, but I don't think I saw the later seasons that you're talking about. Like, is it still the same kind of animation style all the way through, or did it evolve in any way?
I'd say it's pretty much the same style. I mean, they do a little bit of world building, and that there'll be like an underwater battle with a Jedi that has, you know, can breathe underwater, and him facing off against droid fish type things, you know, and all sorts of. So they're generating new Star Wars content, but they're also, I think they begin following some of Anakin's things too, so that they can tie it into the third movie, episode 3, I should say. It kind of stays the whole 2D style, and then it builds a little arc of Anakin kind of overcoming a Sith and almost turning to the dark side. And then there's, I guess it's just him and Obi-Wan's relationship kind of developing. But it's, I wouldn't say it's that strong in that particular way. Like, it doesn't tell that great of a story.
So that you don't have to watch them sequentially or anything.
Not
like
really.
That.
I feel like it's more like catch as you can. It really is just a series of awesome moments in a lot of ways, and less of a whole work.
Do you think that lends itself to watching them all at once, or as they first came out, where you just get bits and pieces of it, you know?
I mean, I did like watching it all at once. It is pretty short, like 2 hours. So I think the only problem with watching it all at once is you end up kind of getting bogged down with the long waiting action scenes, because there are so many of them. They are kind of numerous. So taking a break, taking a couple breaks in there is worth it.
It's not paced necessarily to watch everyone all at once.
Yeah.
That kind of fits how I read comic books. When I read comic books, I get a stack of them. I get a stack of like 8, and then I'll read one. And the narrative will be so satisfying that it's like, I don't want to read anymore. Like, I want to sit here and enjoy this little 20-minute story I just read. I don't want to dive right into the next narrative and the next narrative and the next narrative.
Yeah,
because each one has its own beginning and end.
Right. So, are they all on a DVD or
They're split between two DVDs?
Okay.
Yeah. So the library has the first volume, and then the second one you can get requested through our system.
So maybe it's a good idea to pause every once in a while, and you know, let one of them sink in, or do the dishes real quick and come back. You know, clear your mind somehow, cleanse the palate. Okay, so that is, it's just called Clone Wars?
It's called, Star Wars, Clone Wars, Volume 1 is the name of the first DVD, and then Volume 2. Yeah, if you search Clone Wars 2003, you should be able to find the correct one, because most searches for Clone Wars will give you the other animated series, which started in 2008.
Yeah.
Definitely much longer. It's like 5 seasons, I think,
or something like that. So. Yeah, so we're talking about like flat 2D animation as opposed to the CG three-dimensional looking characters that came later. Okay, great. Thanks, Tony.
Thanks.
Speaking of Star Wars, we are going to talk about Rogue One today. Rogue One is 2016's Star Wars movie. Apparently, they're going to start releasing Star Wars movies once a year. That's the plan.
For how long?
As long as they're profitable, I'm sure. But, I mean, they've got them planned for the next 4...
Till 2020.
Episode 8 and Episode 9, and then the Han Solo movie.
Yeah,
and then
Boba Fett, I think?
Maybe.
Is the next one. I'm not sure if that's confirmed.
Yeah. But anyway, today we're going to talk about Rogue One. It's in theaters now, so it's not at the library just yet. So what did we think of Rogue One, A Star Wars Story?
I really, really like this one even more than I really, really loved. Like, if you go back and listen to our first episode, I was like singing the praise of The Force Awakens. But I had my expectations really high still, but I also didn't want to just see a rinse and repeat of any of the other old Star Wars movies, and I didn't get that. But any time that any of the old Star Wars tropes came back, I was like really, really happy too. So it really gave best of both worlds in that regard. It was a brand new story, it was really cool characters, and it was witty and funny all the way through. So,
as a non-super Star Wars fan, as someone who has just seen them once but, you know, feels good about them but not doesn't know anyone's name or anything like that, I enjoyed it as a movie. So as like a very casual viewer, I really liked the acting by what's her name, by Jin. What's her real name? Felicity Jones. I really liked Felicity Jones. I thought she did a really good job as Jin and showing the arc of kind of her being more reluctant hero or not knowing what path she wants to follow, and then but through the whole time being like this fierce fighter. So I really enjoyed it. I liked that it was darker, and I like when people die. So I enjoyed this one. It seemed like the stakes were high. Mm-hmm. So
the stakes were very high for this one, absolutely. I'm a little hot and cold on this one, and I'm maybe not hot and cold, like hot and warm. There's some things I really liked and some things I was just kind of okay with. The new actors, the new characters, I liked very much. I thought they were great. I liked some of the settings because Star Wars The Force Awakens kind of missed a little bit of the weirdness that I think Star Wars movies have.
I remember you talking about that.
And I think this one brought it back a little bit. They went to the planet with the original Jedi Temple, and, you know, it's kind of a dump. There's beggars in the street. It's not a place where you'd want to live. And I thought, like, that was an interesting contrast, that it wasn't some beautiful, pristine planet. I liked very much the action sequences, especially the big, blown-out, huge battle at the end, where they're on the planet, and there's also a battle going on in space at the same time, and they're trying to steal the plans to the Death Star while all these people are fighting outside. I thought that was very good. I thought there were too many shout-outs to the original Star Wars. C-3PO and R2-D2 show up for about 6 seconds and just totally distract you, totally take you out of the experience. And it's like, oh my God, look at them. What are they going to do? Oh, nothing. Oh, well, you just pulled me out of the experience kind of for nothing.
Just a lot of fan service, did it feel like?
A little bit. The fan service that there was distracting. I thought Darth Vader was done very well in the two scenes that featured Darth Vader. So I didn't think that was so much fan service as it kind of served the plot. As opposed to, you know, they run into the two guys from the Mos Eisley Cantina down there. The he doesn't like you guy and I don't like you either guy. Like, why? Why do that? It's just weird. Because if you've seen A New Hope, you recognize those guys, but it does nothing. If you haven't seen A New Hope, then it just confuses you and does nothing. So I thought those scenes were kind of weird. But then it led into, like, that particular moment. I'm like, this is weird. But then it led into a great action scene on the streets of
Jeddah.
And I thought the guy playing Krennic was great. The most accessible villain that we have. There's kind of a lot of villains in this movie. Darth Vader's in this movie. Krennic's in this movie.
Moff Tarkin.
Tarkin is in this movie. What did we think about Grand Moff Tarkin?
His CG face was really strange to look at when I first saw it.
Very frozen. Like, just like...
like gelatinous,
like,
or something.
Cryogenically, like a Madame Tussauds version of himself.
So for those who don't know Star Wars very well, Grand Moff Tarkin is in A New Hope. He's the bad guy who runs the Death Star, more or less. You know, Leia says, you're the one holding Vader's leash. That's Grand Moff Tarkin. That's the guy. That actor has passed away, but they decided the character was essential to the story, so they put in a CG model walking around with real actors around them, and I thought the performance was pretty good. They had a real actor say the lines and model the face and all that stuff, but the end result I thought was very poor. It again took you right out of the experience. You're no longer enjoying the movie. You're criticizing and
like
critiquing.
How did they do this, like what kind of
you're thinking about the morality of putting an actor's likeness in a movie. You're not thinking about fun time Star Wars. You're thinking about ethics.
Especially now that Carrie Fisher died, too. Now I was thinking, like, I was reading that they had his estate's approval to do that and everything, but even if your generation's future on say something's okay, like, how do you control who gets your likeness? Like, how close does it have to be considered your likeness? Like, and it just was visually unappealing.
It was visually unappealing. I think that more important maybe than the ethics of it was just that it just looked bad. Like, why do it if it looks bad? Krennic is a perfectly good villain. They could have had, if they really wanted Tarkin, they could have had a little hologram of him saying, you know, good work working on the Death Star, and then he goes away, and then that's that. Like, that would have been okay. To that point, though, they actually came out and made an announcement about Carrie Fisher. They said they will not CG Carrie Fisher into the future Star Wars movies.
Good to know.
But weird, right?
That
they have to say that. Yeah.
They have to make that statement on StarWars.com. So I think the movie is a lot of fun, without a doubt. The action scenes are great. The characters are interesting. The environments are kind of hit and miss. Some of them are cool, but there's a lot of grungy rebellion, hiding in the shadows, living underground type of grayness to the movie that I didn't like that so much, but, you know, what are you going to do? That's kind of how you have to portray the rebellion.
I liked, or what did you guys think of the Forrest Whitaker, like, Bane-style getup or character, or how he had that, he was breathing into that face.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
I thought that was
like,
really
creepy,
cool.
Yeah. Like, that weirdness, I thought was
The weirdness was very much Star Wars. And this is kind of what I mean to go back. Like, I mean, I loved the Easter eggs. They were all right, but you're right. They totally detract. Whereas this thing totally added to Star Wars, but it also, it was a guy with a respirator. So it also is a callback to Darth Vader, right? And it totally made, like, the ominous. Everything about him was really scary at first. You didn't know whether he was good or bad. But yet it's all practical and it's all right there, visceral in front of you. Right. So it's really Star Wars. And I thought they just nailed it with that character. The squid underground was kind of a miss for me just because it was so CG and it had no bearing on the plot really.
Yeah, it had no bearing on the plot. It was just like, we need a weird monster so we can check that box off on a checklist somewhere. So they just made up a weird monster to fit this moment. But it kind of had, like, the pilot was supposedly driven insane by the squid, but he seemed all right to me.
Right after he was in that prison, he, like, jumped back up again.
He just needed a minute.
PTSD for one moment.
Oh, but I don't want to forget about talking about the awesome Death Star and how much better it was than the Planet Killer base or whatever it was called. Star Killer base from Force Awakens. Because the Death Star, it seemed like, did so much more damage because you were right in the wake of its destruction in this movie. Whereas in The Force Awakens, it's kind of this abstract, oh, planets are getting blown up and CG explosions again, which has been done in the past and didn't really have that great of effect in Force Awakens, in my opinion. But
here you're like on Jedi.
You're on Jedi.
You saw the people that lose their lives and I thought things like that. Yeah. So it was a lot more effective.
One thing I was curious about was when I was looking at different reviews, it seems so split where you have like some huge reviewers hating it and tearing it apart, like the New Yorker, the New York Times also was not good. And then so many of them also like loved it. Why do you think there's like such a split on this film?
I think a couple of reasons. One, I've heard people say the exact opposite of what I think about the characters. Like, I love the characters. I thought they were well acted. I've heard people hate the characters. They think that they're one-dimensional.
Okay.
So I don't know what leads people to one conclusion and leads some people to the other, but I think, like, that's a major split.
Yeah.
Whether or not you like the characters or not determines whether or not you like the movie or not. And two, it was a weird movie to categorize. Like, some people say it's a war film, like Saving Private Ryan, and I don't think it's like that. But nor is it a Star Wars film like Return of the Jedi, exactly. So I think that it makes you a little uncomfortable to hear, you know, Star Wars Rogue One, a Star Wars story, and then you go into it and you're like, this is kind of half Star Wars, half something else. Which is great because they need to grow the brand. But on the other hand, it's like, I don't think anyone went into that movie expecting what they got. And so for some people, that was very uncomfortable, I think, to watch this movie and wonder, you know, why is so many people dying, as you as you brought up? Like, that's it's a little rough. It's a little intense as opposed to Star Wars. Star Wars, when a character dies, you know, when Qui-Gon Jinn dies, when Obi-Wan Kenobi dies, it's like one big moment. And in this, there's just a lot more indiscriminate death. It just happens left and right. So that's a lot more troubling. It's a harder emotional note, I think, to pin down, where you can have one big moment and then everyone grieves, as opposed to this, which is like, well, he died, but we got to go. Yeah, we got to move. You know, we need to move to the next action scene because time's running out and we got to whatever. So
if we're thinking of The Force Awakens as, you know, as they're saying, of trying to reboot Star Wars for a younger generation, bring them all into it, how do you feel like this second part, which is not, you know, a Star Wars story, it's a little bit separate, like, how does this form the world of Star Wars for this younger generation who maybe The Force Awakens was their first, like, real Star Wars foray?
That's a good question. For one, I think it kind of kicks into Episode 4, A New Hope, the 1977 Star Wars. So not only is it a prequel to it, but it's like the prologue to it. It runs right up into A New Hope. So there's a number of people who I've talked to here at the library who say, oh, I've seen Episode 2, but I haven't seen anything else. They've seen a prequel, but they haven't seen the original 70s and 80s movies.
Wait, they've seen Episode 2, but not anything else?
Something like that, I've heard people say things like that.
Interesting. My friends in high school wanted to see this movie, so I went to...
So yeah, I went to the theater, because that's what was out, but I haven't gone ahead and seen the other movies. So I think this kind of kicks people into, if you haven't seen episode 4, go see episode 4, because that's what happens next after this movie. So I think it kind of revitalizes those a little bit. And I think it kind of ties into 3 and 4 a little bit better than the cartoons have done, where the rebellion being conflicted and Mon Mothma can barely hold this alliance of senators together, and they're secret and they're weak compared to the Empire, and they're not sure if they should even be exercising military power in the first place, or whether that's totally against their... So I think that's an interesting kind of build up to the rebellion in 4, 5, and 6, when 4, 5, or 6 is like, yeah, we're a military power, we're the underdogs, but we've got a lot of fight in us. Rogue One kind of establishes that intermediate period where they didn't know quite what they were. We're a rebellion, but are we a political rebellion? Are we a military rebellion? Are we a philosophical rebellion? Are we a little bit of all three?
There's not a united front fully yet.
Right. And I like that you brought that up, too, because I think that Rogue One also establishes it as partially, doesn't have to be completely a war movie, but it's about these military conflicts. And that's what 4, 5, and 6 were originally like. Whereas, like, the conflicts was less emphasized in 1, 2, and 3. It was politics that was emphasized and Jedi and, like, the Force and the journey of a Force user. And there really isn't any Force in Rogue One except for one character. And aside from that, Rogue One does an amazing job of telling those non-Force user stories, and it shows that the galaxy is filled with so many people that are non-Force users that have a stake in the same exact problem.
Sure,
and it's like, there's a lot of that in the original 4, 5, and 6 movies that you get through Han Solo and Leia, so,
So, what do we think? Do we recommend Rogue One? I do.
I recommend it.
I don't think it's perfect. It's not my favorite Star Wars movie. It's hard to say whether or not I like it better than Force Awakens. I think they're kind of similar for very, even though they're very different movies. They've got strengths, they've got some weaknesses. I don't like them as much as Star Wars A New Hope, but I don't like very many things more than I like Star Wars A New Hope.
But your expectations for the next Star Wars movie is higher than for both of these movies, right?
I can't wait for 8.
Yeah. So you have high expectations for that one, right?
I do.
So
I do.
That one would be the disappointing one if it wasn't.
That one would crush me if it's a bad movie. 7, I didn't like so much. I thought it was good in some places and bad in others, kind of like I think with Rogue One. But 8, with the story of, presuming the story of Rey and Luke Skywalker and him training a new Jedi and him filling the Ben Kenobi role, like, that's my Star Wars. That's what I want to see. Han Solo and Finn and Poe Dameron were great, but they're not what I'm here for. I'm here for training a new Force user and seeing how she handles her power, because in a lot of ways, like, her power is manifesting stronger than Anakin's did. So how she handles her powers and is thrust into this fight, even though she has no sense of home, will be very interesting to me. So I'm very much looking forward to 8. The Han Solo story sounds like fun. What is it? Donald Glover as a young Lando Calrissian? That sounds like a lot of fun to me. But in the meantime, it's Rogue One. Rogue One is probably still in theaters because it is a big movie. So go check it out if you want. It'll be on DVD and Blu-ray at the library sometime down the line, but certainly not today. So thanks, everyone. Thanks, Jamie. Thanks, Tony. And that is a Pint and Click podcast.